And, you know, first of all, let me say on behalf of Ivor and myself that we're delighted to have the opportunity to present to City Council some background information on Aiken Housing Authority and CDSC and the role that the two organizations played in developing housing within the city of Aiken, or in the county of Aiken, as well as CDSC as our initiatives not only just exist in the city limits of the city and county of Aiken, but we have initiatives statewide in South Carolina as well, and some projects in North Carolina from CDSC standpoint. So the Housing Authority, as you all know, is strictly in the city of Aiken. So let me just introduce myself. I'm Reginald Barnum. I've been in Aiken and was the director for the Housing Authority since 1994, and decided to make a transition the first of the year. So I'm operating CDSC and will hopefully continue to do that. And Ivory is currently serving as acting CEO of Aiken Housing Authority throughout this transition period. And within the 21-month period of time that the board has discussed, we will transition that Ivory would then be serving as the CEO of Aiken Housing Authority. I'll let Ivory introduce herself. And then the other thing that we wanted to do after that is if everyone could just again introduce themselves, and so that way we all collectively know who we are and who we're referring different questions to. Okay.
Hello, my name is Ivory Matthews, and I've been here in the Aiken community for approximately a little over 12 years. Most of you I know, and some of you I've just met tonight. I am from a little small town that's about 20 miles east of here. It's famous for two things that I know of. One is used to be the asparagus capital of the world. And the other thing is we're also the home of Senator Strom Thurmond's very first wife. So I'd like to find out a little bit of historical factors about where I'm from and share those with people. Since I've been here in the Aiken community, I have held various capacities. I've worked for Lower Savannah Council of Governments office in the capacity of the Workforce Development Department, which covers six counties in South Carolina. In that role, I serve as the supervisor of contracts and one-stop career centers. Most of you know one-stop career centers are centers such as the Employment Security Commission office. Aiken Technical College has a one-stop career center. And then there's a one-stop career center over on York Street designed to handle the individuals who have been dislocated through the Avondale Mills dislocation. And we'll talk a little bit more about the Workforce Development Department as we currently administer those programs as well. I have, in my current role at Aiken Housing Authority, I've been there for approximately 5 years, and I've served in various capacities there at the agency as well. I provided to you a small handout, a PowerPoint handout that gives some good information about a little bit about my background. And before we go on to do the introductions of everybody, I do want to explain the information that I provided to everybody in the binder. This binder, if you turn to the front tab, we provide it for reference material just in case you have any questions after the meeting. Please feel free to give me a call if you have any questions or any additional clarification that we provided this information to you as reference material. The first handout is the presentation that we're going to provide tonight. The second handout is South Carolina State Enabling Legislation, which provides information about how public housing authorities were created in the state of South Carolina. Then next, we provide a handbook for public housing commissioners, which gives you a little bit more information about our commissioner's role. Then we provide fact sheets on public housing, Section 8, and we provide some information about Aiken Housing Authority and CDIC's bylaws that governs our commissioners and our board of directors. Next, if we could do our introductions, if we could start with Sarah.
I'm Sarah Wood, I'm chairman of the CDIC board and the board of the Aiken Housing Authority.
I'm James Goldman, I'm chair of the Aiken Housing Authority board, and of course, a member of the CDIC board as well.
I'm Channing Jones. I've been on the commission on boards for the Aiken Housing Authority and CDIC for about a year.
I'm Don Wells, Aiken City Council.
I'm Martin Buckley. I will be on the housing board.
I'm Beverly Kleinman, member of Aiken City Council.
Tim DeWard, also a member of Aiken City Council.
Jane Butters, Aiken City Council.
If you turn to the next slide in your handout, one of the things that we wanted to do, we had a few questions that City Council, you guys provided to us, and we wanted to make sure that we addressed all these areas as we go through our presentation. The first one is the roles and responsibilities of Aiken Housing Authority and its affiliated organization. Community Development Improvement Corporation. We'll go in detail about those roles of each of those entities. We'll talk with you about how funds are raised from CDIC and how Aiken Housing Authority is funded. Aiken Housing Authority is funded on the annual contributions contract that it signs with the United States Department of Labor and, United States Department of Housing and Urban Development. Next, we'll go over the sources of funding for Aiken Housing Authority and CDIC and the exact relationship between the two. Then we'll talk about the Aiken Housing Authority's history in cleaning up problem neighborhoods such as Crossing Park and other neighborhoods with obvious problems. Next, we'll discuss Aiken Housing Authority and CDIC's relationship with higher staff of the City of Aiken. And we'll talk about AHA CDIC wants to see the Aiken Housing Commission work on. And that, the last bullet will need, Ms. Baldwin, I know, had sent me that last bullet, and so we'll need to get some more clarification from you guys in terms of the Aiken Housing Commission. Under the agenda, we'll talk about Aiken Housing Authority first. I'll cover aspects of the Aiken Housing Authority, and then we'll cover the aspects of Community Development Improvement Corporation, and then we'll do the summary, which will provide highlights.
Can we just sort of back up? We have Aiken Housing Authority, we have CDIC, and then we have the Aiken Housing Commission. What is the Aiken?
No, there was a question on the role. Ms. Waters, you had indicated a question on the commission.
That's not exactly the way I meant to phrase it. There's the Aiken Housing Authority, which is a commission. The CDIC, which is a separate corporation.
The Housing Authority is not a commission. The Housing Authority is a board. The Housing Authority is not a commission of the city. It's a separate entity, corporation that was created in 1941. So that's one of the differences of what you all look at from an operational standpoint as city commissions. And the Housing Authority is, in fact, not a commission of the city. It's a separate entity and a separate board. And prior to the late 1990s, the only issuing authority, and I was going to talk about some of that, but just from a historical perspective, housing authorities were created in 1937, but from an appointment standpoint, until in the late 1990s, this federal law and state law, South Carolina, the only person that appointed housing authority board members was appointed solely and exclusively by the mayor of every town. And what happened is in 1990s, there was a former city council member in Greenville who became a state representative. And when he became a state representative, he pushed for legislation to change the state law that allows city council members to then have the ability to make recommendation to the mayor for the appointment. Around that same time, like a year later, the City of Aiken Council went through a change in how you all made a decision to appoint board members. And when you did that, then Aiken Housing Authority, because it was a separate board, you all came back and said, we want to now change Aiken Housing Authority. Our rules and regulations supersede local rules because on the Housing Authority side, we're governed by federal law, not local law. And so while I was going to talk about the dynamics of the Housing Authority, to answer your question more specifically, is when that changed, you all came back and wanted that appointment authority for all seven slots. We're governed by federal law that requires a resident commissioner to be on the Housing Authority board. And so that's why one is automatically removed of that seven, because you have to have a resident board member. And then the other position, we came to City Council back then and asked that we leave one slot available, because as you can see in Ivor's presentation, in 1941, there were two housing authorities created in this city. There was a housing authority for the City of Aiken, and there was a housing authority for the county. The county never took action. So the county relinquished the authority for the authority, housing authority, to the city, which made us the housing authority that covers all of Aiken County. So the first two developments that were ever built in the city by statute in the bylaws was Stony Homes was designated for blacks, and Valley Homes in Gloverville was designated for whites during that period of time in the 1940s. They both went into circulation in 1951. And so the first development that was ever built by the Housing Authority, one of them was in Gloverville in the county, one was Stone, and then the last development the Housing Authority ever built from a public housing standpoint was New Hope Development, which is in the county. So the county council has always had an argument that the majority of the units were in the county, not in the city. And then when you look at Section 8, the majority of those families live in the county, all over Aiken County as well. And so what we did is we asked City Council, back when the rules was changed, to leave one available, because County Council said at some point they would like to make a recommendation for someone to serve on the Housing Authority Board that represented the county. And then we required by federal law to have one resident commissioner. So that's why we currently have six, but one, there's sort of five appointed, one resident board member, and then the one is still available, because that was requested to leave that free for potential a county representative that you all would make a recommendation to serve. So even though it still comes through ratification of you all, it would still get some representation from the county, because we actually are the housing authority of Aiken County, even though the name says the housing authority of the City of Aiken.
So has the county ever appointed a person?
The county has an appointed. Bill Shepard was the county administrator when we were doing all of this, and so we were working with county council at that time, and then since then, we've still not have worked out with them for an appointment to the board. But that's why it was left available.
Thank you. Does federal or state law require that there be seven members? Is that the...
The change in state law says that you can have up to seven members. So you don't have to have seven. Some cities still have five, and so therefore city council, because in most communities, Aiken was different in the sense that you all changed it to have everyone to have an appointment. Where some just, the state law just says that city council has input in now appointing the representative, where before it was strictly only the mayor made that appointment.
So two of the members of council don't have appointments. That's why I was asking if they could be larger, you know, so we'd have seven plus the representative plus, but that's not legal.
Well, it would have to amend state law currently. because it's at 7. And one has to be a resident board member.
Sure.
Because it's what HUD did in 1998 in a new revised law, the 37 Housing Act, is they came back and said the Housing Authority's board should have at least one representative of the people that they serve.
But we could, I mean, we could amend it for our county?
No, you would have to, it would have to be amended statewide. So it would have to take legislative action.
So much for home rule.
Statewide.
Well, I've skipped through a couple of slides, and the history, as Mr. Barnum touched on a little bit early in his presentation. I wanted to share this information with everyone to make sure it is good information about how the Housing Authority was started here in the city of Aiken. And you'll see it starts with the 1937 Housing Act. And then in May of 1940, Mayor W.J. Mosley and the City Council of Aiken passed a resolution to form the Housing Authority of the City of Aiken. As Mr. Barnum stated, in 1951, Stoney Homes was our first development, which was created in the city, and Glover and Valley Homes was created in the county of Aiken. And in the 1960s, we also developed Bush Homes and Barber Homes. And as you'll see later in the presentation, these are two developments that we demolished and replaced them with single-family housing under a low-income housing tax credit development program. And we still have Heim Village. Heim Village is our largest housing development. It is actually where our administrative offices are currently located. That development has 100 units in it. And then we also still have New Hope 1 and New Hope 2. And that development is adjacent to each other. It's on, as you go towards Augusta, on Aiken Augusta Highway. Once you get in Grandville, it's on the far right of the hill. Okay. The mission statement of Aiken Housing Authority is to assist low-income families, all families, not just public housing families. And this is according to the 1949 Housing Act, which designated housing authorities to provide housing not just for a particular group of incomes, particular group of individuals in the community who had specific incomes, but for an entire community.
And I think that's important to note, if I can interject, that it wasn't until the 1940s, 43 in exact, am I right, Ivory?
Yeah.
That the Federal Housing Administration even created funding for housing. So when housing authorities were created, as you can imagine, to build new homes in the community in the 1930s, Techwood Homes in Atlanta was the first public housing developed in the country. It was torn down when the Olympics came, and now you have Georgia State and Georgia Tech's dorms right there on 75-85. But that was the first public housing in the country that was built in the 1940s. But it was never intended, if you will, that housing authorities were only supposed to just be public housing. And as you can imagine, even during that period of time, public housing was some of the best housing that was created as far as indoor plumbing, indoor toilets, those kinds of things. So it wasn't subsidized housing, and Ivor will share, subsidized housing didn't even come a part of public housing until after 1969.
This is a list of Aiken Housing Authority's Board of Commissioners. Our current chairperson, as you know, is here, Mr. Gallman, and we have proposed Mr. Shannon Jones as our vice chair, which Mr. Robert Stack just resigned from our board, and so Mr. Jones will be taking his place.
I'm still confused. The vacant position, is that the one that the county has not filled?
The vacant position right now is Mr. Stacks that Mr. Okay. Buckley will fill. So there's still a position, but we've not ever looked at it as vacant because it's just not been appointed. But it would be two vacant positions if you looked at it from that standpoint.
But are you de facto a legal member of the Housing Authority? or are you just the CEO? I don't mean just. Are you the CEO and board reports to you?
No.
No. No. She is a staff person. We have currently five board members. We're anticipating a sixth one.
Okay.
That's still going to leave one that we are not filling. So we will have six. Once the appointment, however it is proposed that this be done, replacing Mr. Robert Stack, that will give us six positions then.
At least you know why we asked for this meeting.
Yes.
A lot of questions. Okay, thank you.
And the position of the executive director or the CEO of the Aiken Housing Authority, that position is the only position that reports to the Board of Commissioners.
Okay.
Also, I added a note section here at the bottom, which talks about our how we, the Board of Commissioners, have rotated on an annual basis the position of chairman and vice chair seats. And that is done, and the board has done over a number of years, where it gives everybody a fair opportunity to serve in the position of vice chair or chair. And typically, each member usually serves about a year on the board before they rotate into the position of chair or vice chair.
And I think that that's something to highlight, that one of the things that Aiken Housing Authority Board historically has always worked well together, and you know, from a cooperative spirit standpoint, where some housing authorities in South Carolina and other places, where sometimes the chair has been the chair for 10 years, 20 years, or whatever the case may be, here it's always been a friendly board to work together where they just rotate. And so that way it gives everybody a chance to be chair, and we have an interactive relationship.
And no more than half can be on the CDIC board?
That's correct. In order for us to get, and we're going to get to, why we set it up the way we did and how that function operates.
And this commissioner's appointment, this is the information that we just finished discussing in regards to the number of individuals who can be appointed to the Housing Authorities Board. And this came directly out of our state enabling legislation. I've also provided to you, each of you, a consolidated flow chart, which has Aiken Housing Authority and CDIC's commissioners and board of directors, and all of its employees representing the various departments. And that's the first one is consolidated, the second one is Aiken Housing Authority, and the third is CDIC.
Could you go back to the two more?
The programs that are administered by the Aiken Housing Authority is low rent public housing, our housing choice voucher program, or as individuals, it's best known as Section 8. We have a tenant-based rental assistance program, which is similar to our Section 8 program, the summer food service program, and the AmeriCorps Vista program. First, we'll talk about low rent public housing. As we stated earlier, public housing was established to provide safe, decent, and sanitary housing for individuals of the community. Where does our funding come from? Was one of the questions I think Mrs. Valerie said, provided in her email. And our funding primarily comes from annual contributions contract signed with the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And that contract provides us with capital funds, which we use to replace things that, such as appliances and roofs and things that have reached their natural life. And then we have operating subsidies, which we're funded at a very small amount of operating subsidies. And you'll, further in the presentation, I'll show you the funding breakdown from that point of view. And then we have the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program, where we receive rental assistance funds and administrative funds. The eligibility for public housing, to be eligible for public housing, you must be at 80% of the area median income or below. And 80% of the area median income, if you look at the very bottom chart, that's the low income. So for a person of one, they can't exceed the income of $30,400 a month. One of the things that HUD does require, although we are to be eligible, we have to be at 80% or below. One of the things that they require on an annual basis is that the first 40% of individuals that we house are 30% of the area median income or below. So if you look at the first line in the chart where it says 30% of the median income for a person of one is $11,400. Once we serve 40% of our individuals, meet that guideline, then we begin to serve individuals who are of higher incomes. And we also, in our public housing developments, have a preference system, which is a working preference. And we place that preference system because we want to make sure we have a variety of individuals living in public housing and not just the very, very low income, but also working individuals as well.
A very low-income person wouldn't necessarily have a problem for low-income?
Well, once we meet the 40% threshold, then we can skip over the 30% individual and house the individual who is working.
I'm still not with you. Once you meet your 30%, 40%, in other words, 40% of the occupants receive 30% of median income?
Yes, sir.
And that's local median, it's determined locally?
Yes.
So once you get to that 40%, then the other 60%, would somebody on a very low income who makes less than someone on a low income, would they have priority over the low income person? In other words, does income then have a role in deciding who gets the units?
It's based on a preference system. And as I've alluded to, we have a preference system. So we have homelessness as a preference, working families as a preference. So after you meet that 40% requirement, then based on your date and time of application and your preference that's approved by the board, then you get selected accordingly. So if you don't meet one of those preferences.
So who makes the final decision on the person getting in?
The waiting list. It's all driven by the waiting list and the preference system. So we don't arbitrarily go in and say, okay, we're going to take you, we're going to take you, we're going to take you. We have a computerized system that basically calculates the waiting list and the scoring system. And everybody, no matter who you are, you're based on date and time of application. And so we go through that. The computer spits out on a weekly basis, daily basis, when we want to make a selection. It'll tell us, in this particular category, who's the next person in line. So that way we go based on the computerized system. Mm-hmm.
But you know, there are a lot of people that think that if somebody gets a unit over them and they make more money than the person who didn't get the unit, they think that somehow that's not fair. But I guess all the times I've ever called, it's been some other factor there.
Sure, and I'm glad that you brought that up, and I was going to talk about that with the Brook Amendment. And all of that really changed, Ms. Clyde, and you're absolutely correct. Prior to 1969, public housing was no different from any housing in America. If you talk to most military people, you know, prior to 1969, a lot of military people, some still qualify based on what we think military privates, but prior to 69, you had most of it was working class families. And so you had a budget, just like any other business. You determined how much you can make or, you know, from your rents. And so you took some low income people, you took some medium income people, but it's just like any other business, you had to meet your mark. And then after 1969, in the Brook Amendment, Senator Edward Brooks from Massachusetts came up with the Brook Amendment and said, no, as a country, going to what you just said, we need to focus on the lowest income to let them in first, and then we can start focusing on the other people, because if we strictly go on ability to pay, the poorest of the poor in this country never get adequate housing And so that's why we focus 40% at 30% of medium or below. Then we can go to the other. It gives some equity, if you will, in offering housing, but it also allows, and that's when the federal subsidy came into play, because then what Housing Authority said is, we've been operating without any subsidy, now you tell us to take the poorest of the poor. These people, if they're only paying 30% of their income is $200, I can't run my business off $200. So what the government then came back and said, the fair market value is this, and we, so if they pay 200, but the regular value is 600, the government subsidizes that difference to make a housing authority whole. But as I will share with you, we're not even whole anymore, because now they've reduced that amount.
And that leads into our next slide, which the Brook Amendment brought about operating subsidy. Prior to that, housing authorities didn't have any operating subsidies. And so as you see, if you take a look at our chart, our operating subsidies are dwindling each year. HUD is funding us at a lower rate each year. And I think just this year we're funded at 83%.
So what we look at is, just like any other business, we put our budget together, and if you had to come in and put your budget together for your business, and then all of a sudden somebody comes in and tells you, based on what you get from the tenants and what you need from us to make you at 100%, now we're only going to give you 83% of that, but we still want you to make it work. But you can't charge the people any more than what they can pay, and you got to take 40% of the poorest of the poor because they come first. But we're only going to give you 83% of what it takes you to be whole.
Reggie, what happened in 2005?
2005, the federal government shut down. And so, if you recall, we had continuing resolution after continuing resolution. And so, the subsidy completely dropped down a great deal. And so, what we had to do was take our reserves. We had to take capital funds that we get monies to help fix up the units, like we're doing with Stony Homes now. Again, prior to 1993, there was no formula from HUD to even do repairs on the units, from 1951 in some cases. So as you can see, we've managed well with what the federal government has given us. And so that year, as Mr. Garvin alluded to, we had to use our reserves that we had built up to operate the agency because the federal government shut down that year.
As Mr. Barner just mentioned, you'll see the first line that says the comprehensive grant funds from 1999 to 2001. These were funds that were given to housing authorities on a competitive basis, so you had to apply for this funding in order to receive dollars to replace some of the dilapidated units or repairs that you might have had in your developments. And then from 2001, HUD began to create a formula in terms of how much money they provide to an entity for capital funds, and these are not capital funds dollars.
And as you can see, it went up from 01, 02, and 03, which was the highest point, and then it's been steadily dwindling every year. But your housing stock, if you go back and you look across the country, is steady going down. But most of your public housing was built from 1940s to 1965. So as you can tell, they're aging. And just like Stony, they were dilapidated. And so we'll talk about how we had to borrow to do that kind of work to rehab.
It is, when you talk about public housing like this, you mean groups of housing units together, correct? So I thought there was a trend toward more individual homes.
For Section 8.
That's Section 8.
Yes, ma'am.
But this is houses. This is on Section 8.
Right.
So in Stony Homes,
that's public housing.
That's public housing, not Section 8.
Yes, ma'am.
Which is different than.
Right. We own, look at it from this way, Ms. Vargas, going forward. Mr. Dewar had this conversation with me when he was running for office. Public housing we own. Section 8, private people own. All we do is give a subsidy for their rent. But we don't own the houses, and we don't control who landlords select.
Think they're
in line, so. You make sure they qualify for Section 8.
And right. Yeah. And that's only, and I'm glad there lies the problem. And I tell people, going back to what you said, our job is only to take an application for a low-income family that qualifies. The federal government mandates we do that. Even though we can't house people with a drug conviction and a felony charge, we can't house them. But we have to take their application. So when we get to the Section 8 issues, and that's where the problem comes, and we talk to landlords about this till we're blue in our face, is we're required by federal law to take an application on anybody. You all can come in there and apply. Now, whether or not you qualify is a different situation. So we have to take an application on anyone. Then, if they don't have a felony and they don't have a criminal record, they can get a voucher. The decision to accept them has nothing to do with us. It is strictly when I come to your house and knock on your door with a voucher and say, I would like to rent your house. If you take it, and don't do a background check on me on my previous rental history, we're not allowed to do that. The federal government says all our job is to take applications for qualified, eligible people. The landlord has the responsibility, like in any other situation, to do credit checks, to do background checks, to do rental history checks, and if they find that they tore up the last house that somebody lived in, they lived in, if they got a bad record from their living situation and they deplorable, the landlord says, I'm not going to take you, just like he would do on anybody else. But what happens is, if I know that I'm going to be guaranteed money every month, where if I take this other lady and she lose her job and my rent is $600 a month, what happens? I'm going to be looking for $600 a month and she can't pay it. But if I take this lady with Section 8 and her portion is $200 and the housing authority subsidizes $400, Ms. Barber, believe it or not, we have landlords that call me every day that are friends of mine, qualified business people in this community, that say, Reggie, I haven't collected the tenant's portion in 3 years. But guess what happens in 3 years? 36 months comes, that a $200 a month per month is built up, and they get on the phone, and they call you all, and they call other people in the community, and they say, what? Those Section 8 tenants had paid me my money. Forget about the fact that they didn't collect it. Forget about the fact they didn't try to collect it. Now they want to kick them off. And guess what the judge does? The judge says, you've been derelict in your responsibility to be a good landlord. You let this lady live here for 36 months and didn't collect it. And so the judge won't put them out because the landlord has been here. And then now everybody is talking at dinner parties and catching me at chamber functions and everything else. And then bad mouth the Section 8 program, and I have to remind them, it wasn't Section 8 that created the problem.
However, it's a hard call because, I mean, there honestly are some landlords that, I mean, I'm sorry, but in our office we deal with Medicaid. They can't make some of those co-payments, and I don't.
Sure.
We surely see them. We're not going to not see them because they can't do that, you know. And, I mean, I think some landlords must be like that in that. Because what's going to happen if you don't? If you say, all right, you're not paying me, you're out on the street? I mean, is that what that happens?
Well, what happens is, if they don't pay, it's not making the situation better for them, for us as a community.
I just love it, though, when people say, it's your fault because you're not trying to collect. Well, yeah, right.
Well, and I agree with you, but the only question that I say is, I like what your answer is. We made a decision. Mm-hmm. Not to collect because we recognize they can't pay that copay. But that's not what we hear. What we hear is that it's your fault It's your problem, and you need to fix it, and it's Section 8. And so when a community perspective comes in, everybody looks at it and says, look how bad Section 8 is. When if the landlord is truthfully honest, as many have told me prior, well, Rich, I know it's my fault. I said, well, why didn't you tell your friend that who called me to say that we're the problem, that we got these derelict tenants?
How many years is a voucher? Like, if you give someone the right to have a voucher, how long does that last, that right?
Well, the voucher lasts as long as the individual is eligible for the program.
So every year, every month, every year, do they reapply?
Individuals who are under the Section 8 program, if they have a change of family composition, meaning someone moved in or moved out, or if they have a change in their income, whether they lose income or gain income, whether it be earned income or unearned income, they have to report that to us. And once they report that information to us, then we do a recertification of the family's income and household status to see if they still are eligible for the program.
And then you would notify the landlord if they were not, and the landlord would know he'd have to collect, or she
yes.
would have to collect.
Up or down. And that's why we remind people it's a subsidized program. The more you make, the less we pay. The less you make, the more we pay. Yeah. But yes, ma'am.
Do you take into consideration health care, school fees, and those kinds of things when you?
We can. We would love to. The only people we get to even look at that stuff for is elderly people. Okay. We can look at their
so
medical expenses.
When you certify someone as being able to pay $200, that's based on the money they've got coming in and the number of people in the family.
And the sad reality of it is, it's the gross, and that's one of the things.
The gross?
Yes. That's the sad reality. It is based on the gross anticipated income less the eligible deduction. We agree. That is wrong. Basically, low-income people are not even bringing that money home, and their rents are charged based on the gross 30%. And then we charge that rent, and then we subsidize the difference. So by the time they get to bring something home with insurance and all of those other things, it's not equitable because it was based on the gross amount. And for 20 years I've been doing this, and I remind people all the time, please contact your congressman, your senators on the federal level, and discuss housing policy. But as we all know, it never comes up in any presidential election. It never comes up on the radar because we're dealing primarily with the lowest income people, so it's not really a large issue.
How many Section 8 people do we have in Aiken?
We've got 800, a little over 815 families.
So you're getting ready to have how many?
Oh, we're getting ready to have 920 families.
We're getting ready to increase. We got some more money from HUD this year, so we're going to...
I have two concerns. How do you make sure that number one, they get decent housing, that the landlord upkeeps, that, you know, if the heater goes out? I mean, I was on the community development board, as Lisa can say, and I heard sad tales of what some usually elderly widowed women had to put up with for heating and so forth. So how do you make sure that housing is standard, number one? And then number two, is there any way, no diplomatic way to say this, but does anybody verify the income? I can see why it would be in someone's best interest to tell you to make as little as possible when they really make more than that. So is there any way to verify income?
Yes. I'll ask the income question and then the inspections. On the income, I think it was maybe 2003, HUD, that was the first year where HUD worked out a collaborative agreement with the state wage record and income data, where we could have access directly to unemployment insurance records, which shows if any company wherever across the United States is paying in their deductions and so forth on employees, and we can have access to that data.
Okay.
And we also got access to data received from the Social Security Administration office. And prior to that, we used third-party data. So an individual would have to go to the social service office and bring back a printout to us so that we could verify their income, or we contact their employer and the employer would complete a verification and send it back to us for employment verification.
And do you do that periodically after they've been qualified?
We do that on an annual basis, okay. And we do it on an interim basis if the families has reported to us that they received a job. If, for instance, if a family is on our program and they received a job in between their annual certification and did not report it to us, then that family, once we do the verification, that family sometimes have to pay back funds to the housing authority. And in some cases, it has been considered fraud, and we have prosecuted we've turned them into our Office of Inspector General for prosecution. And so we do have some real good means of verifying income for families now. The other factor you mentioned was the annual inspection, so making sure that individuals have a place that is decent. One of the things that we do once an individual comes on to the Section 8 program is before we even place that house as a unit that is available for a Section 8 family, we have an inspector who goes out and inspects the units to make sure that it meets housing quality standards. Over a year and a half ago, we realized that we not only want the houses just to meet HUD basic housing quality standards, we wanted to also meet some of the standards that the city and county had in their inspections department as well. So we partnered with the city of Aiken, and the city of Aiken currently does all of our housing inspections inside the city of Aiken. And then we do the housing inspections in the county. And this has been over a year. Been working on this partnership. And I think it's been working pretty good, hasn't it, Lisa? We've been really catching a lot of slumlord situations and rectifying those.
Who in the city does it?
Our property codes inspector, Phil Noah, is certified by HUD to do that.
And it's done when the voucher recipient changes. Is that when it's done? Yeah.
Well, it's done. It's done on an annual basis. And it's also done before the house is even, like say for instance, once we give the individual the voucher to go out to seek housing, that individual hands that voucher to the landlord, then the landlord notifies us that your participant wants to rent my unit. Then we go out and do an inspection before we even say it's okay for the tenant to move in the unit.
I'm sorry to say that. Does the landlord know how many people are supposed to be in the family in order to get this? So if more people move in, the landlord should do something about it.
Yes.
Their responsibility, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Where can they get help? From you?
Mm-hmm.
They can.
They report it. Go ahead.
Yes. They can. They report it to us. One of the things that we do with all our landlords before we even enter an agreement with the landlord is we take them through a briefing. And a briefing is to explain to them all the details of the program and to also talk with them about the factors of enforcing landlord-tenant laws, which we have no jurisdiction over. So we go over that information with the landlord, and we also explain to the landlord, really explain to them that the enforcement of the lease is very critical. And the voucher, we show them a copy of the voucher, which has the dollar amount that's attached to the unit, as well as how many individuals are supposed to be in this particular unit based on that voucher size.
Okay. Well, one of the things I want to say is a lot of the comments that I get as a commissioner is about the issue of Section 8. Going back to what Reggie said, is I try to remind those people that come to me that too often they are so interested in getting the amount that the housing authority is going to pay that they don't look at what is this participant actually able and will pay. And so they don't do a background check themselves. They expect them that the housing authority, only because they have qualified them as Section 8, they expect them to go out, they expect the housing authority to be the one to determine if the person is a good person to have and whatnot. And so you've got this person, a lot of times with a voucher, all they want is a home. Many times they don't report the sad conditions of the house because they want to get in. And you got the owner who won't report that these people not paying because they figure, well, rather than getting nothing out of it, I can get my $400 or $300 out of it, so I'll just take that. So that's that, and the blame then gets pushed back to the housing authority that you all aren't doing what you're supposed to do.
But these inspections must have helped a lot.
I think so. I think it
helped. They have. And also, to just to quantify it in dollar terms, we issue about a little over $300,000 a month in this community for Section 8 landlords. So it's a pretty penny from the housing authority.
I think this is wonderful, and I thank you for having a wonderful conversation and getting some real good information. But I'm wondering if there's a way you can bring all of the people together that have Section 8 homes for rent, if you could bring them together and explain to them.
We did that, Ms. Clyburn. What we did is we did a dinner for landlords. We invite landlords twice a year to the Housing Authority's community room that we provide refreshments and like a dinner to recap and go over these issues as marketing and PR, because we feel like that's the best marketing that we can do to, if the landlords understand these things, then, you know, we do a better job of disseminating that information. And you'd be surprised at the numbers that attend.
You think the landlords
that
are pretty hard?
Or?
It's hard to say. Yeah. I have to write this down or anything. I'm curious.
That's why we worked with the city, Ms. Vargas. Mm-hmm. You know, I got to a point of being in this community. When we get to CDSC, we created CDSC because of deplorable, horrible housing conditions in this community as well. And so we're going to talk about Section 8 people living in substandard homes. And working with Roger, you know, let me say this, that, you know, while I like to take some benefit of when we look at the last 13 years of what has been done in this community, when I came to this community and came to city council meetings, Ms. Clyburn and Ms. Price were discussing those issues on city council. But the housing authority director previous was not adamant to address these issues. And there was not a structure in place at that period of time in the city to really focus on these issues. And so while I came and heard them bringing these issues up every month, the truth of the matter is, in a lot of ways, and I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, but this is what I felt, and I've even never shared that I felt like a lot of what you all were saying every month was falling on deaf ears because there was no structure in place. And so when we kept looking at the conditions, we said we got to do something about it. And what we did about it is CDSC, and then we'll explain why we had to create CDSC to do that versus leaving it under the housing authority.
This slide here talks about the housing opportunities for persons with AIDS. I wanted to bring this particular program to everyone's attention. We operated the program in 2005. We were contacted in 2005 by the city of Augusta. I think they contacted that Aiken County at once.
They contacted the county and city of North Augusta.
They contacted Aiken County and the city of North Augusta. And they received the grant from HUD to provide housing opportunities for persons with AIDS. And this particular grant, what it actually does is it provides individuals with AIDS payments to help them pay their mortgage, as well as rent payments if they're renting. And We help them out in the interim to operate this program. This program is still very active in Aiken. It is operated by Hope Health Incorporated and is housed out of the Aiken County Health Department. So if any of you know someone in this situation who would be eligible, please, you know, refer them to the Hope Health Incorporated. The drug elimination program, this is another program that the Housing Authority had operated for approximately 4.5 years. In this program, what HUD did was to rid all of the negative stimulus that was associated with public housing, some of the drug activity, gang violence, and so forth. What HUD did was it allocated a portion of funds designed to hire or partner with local city and government entities to have police enforcement in their development. And during this time, the Aiken Housing Authority had, I think, two police officers on board who helped here within the city with the city development, and also the county. We also had a county person serving our New Hope and our Valley Home development as well. But in 2002, which you'll see in 2003, the funding dwindled a lot. But in 2002, HUD decided that we were not in the business of policing communities. We wanted to get back to what we do best, and that's housing. And so they gave that responsibility back to the local municipalities so that the housing authorities can work directly with the community police officers as well as the county sheriff department.
And let me interject something. As Ivory indicated, we subsidized two PAC officers during that period of time, and then subsidized with the county as well. But if you read the Columbia newspaper lately, there's some Section 8, not public, run by Housing Authority Section 8. Also, I want you to understand there are apartment complexes that are in Aiken that are Section 8 apartment complexes that have nothing to do with Aiken Housing Authority. You as a private individual can develop apartment complexes, and there was a funding source where you could build an apartment complex and the federal government would give you as a developer Section 8 100% to your development. So there are some developments. So when you, again, you get calls and say, this is, like I ever got a call from HUD Friday that says, we got one of your properties that we're getting complaints from in North Augusta and North Augusta Gardens. Well, North Augusta Gardens is privately owned and it's 100% Section 8. None of it belongs to us. But HUD called us to say, you all need to make a phone call and do something about the conditions at North Augusta Gardens. So we get blamed for anything associated with Section 8 all over Aiken County.
Where would the, I mean, we have them in the city of Aiken then too, housing.
Right. And say, and now, Ms. Vargas, as you were saying, if you remember that, you know, now they call what they're doing is the private developers, or it's calling what you will hear phrases opt out. So they've gotten their 20 years, they've gotten the mortgages completely paid for, and now they're opting out of federal assistance, and Oxford Trace is one of them,
yeah,
who is now turning into condominiums.
What about Cushman on?
Cushman was never, it was Section 8 project-based and then converted now, you know. So what they did is, what was the, there's one, where the apartment complex across from where you used to live on the south side. Charleston, no. There's an apartment complex across, there's a gas station at the fork of Silver Bluff and Pine Log. And Steeplechase used to be a Section 8 apartment complex, and then the owners opted out, and now it's just privately owned market rate units. So what happens again is when you have these Section 8 project-based developments, when they pay off their mortgages after 20 years, they opt out, become market rate. So now you constantly keep losing affordable housing in the community because now those developers completely opt out.
Someone behind South Aiken.
Right. behind South Aiken.
That started out as a regular housing complex, and then as time wore on, I know we got students from over there that were Section 8.
Right, and now
they've gone back.
It's going back now because they got money to fix it up, but to fix it up, it was a wonderful program. It was a rehab program, and the federal government says, we're going to give you the money. Remember my rehab? We're going to give you the money to fix it up, and we're going to give you Section 8 people for every unit to pay your mortgage back to us for the money that we gave you to fix it up. And then when at the end of the 20 years, you don't have to keep these low-income people anymore. You make a market rate, and that's what they're doing in the term of the conduct. So then we continuously lose affordable units in the community.
And sometimes HUD even call us and ask us if we want to purchase the development as well.
Right, like we did in North Augusta, we bought Ridgeview Manor, which was an 88-unit complex, because the owners, at the end of the 20 years, quit paying their mortgage. Well, they had a little mortgage left. So after they got the tax credits for 20 years, they quit paying the mortgage. They lived in Boca Raton, Florida. And so they just quit paying it. So HUD called us and said, would y'all buy the development? And so that's how we bought Ridgeview Manor at a discounted rate, because we're a governmental entity.
Well, I applaud what you do. And I think that more people need to understand what goes on. Because I don't know, Jane, if you get the kinds of calls that I get. And I got one today, you know. And the caller said, you know, I owe $200, and they're going to put me out. But I would imagine that person had probably not been paying it for the last 36 months.
And that $200, you know, the first person, and I know y'all may cringe at this, but, you know, I tell Ivory this all the time, the first person that I put out of housing in Greenville in 1986, young lady owed $2 a month in rent. And she owed us $12 plus $50 per month in court costs when I put her out. And she said, I bet you won't put me out for $2 rent. And I said, you know what? You owe it. You got to pay it. She could have picked up. I mean, she was an able-bodied person, so she wasn't handicapped. But just define. And so you're right. Sometimes when we get to that point, you know, the housing authority had let her stay there all that time, but same thing. She picked up the phone call in Greenville, called a city council person. We had the same situation, I don't know if you all remember, a couple of years ago, where we sent out notices to all of our tenants because they would pay, if their rent was $2.50, they'd pay the $2 and would never pay the 50 cent. And I sent them a notice, and they called 12 on your side. And you remember that, Ms. Clyburn? And I was out there on 12 on your side, and the people said, why would you spend a stamp and an envelope to send somebody a notice for 50 cents? And I said, they owe it. It doesn't matter what it is. The government is a subsidized program. And I said, well, let me ask you this. If we take the 30,000 units in South Carolina, and if you took 50 cents per unit for 30,000 units, that's taxpayer money. They owe it. So while we look at it as one individual, it's 50 cents. But when you do the multiplier effect, that it's 30,000 units, we are charged, just like a minister, we are charged with being a good steward of taxpayer money. And whether it's 25 cents or whether it's $400 a month, based on your income, that's what you owe, that's what we charge it, and that's what we try to collect. And that's the only fair, is based on your particular income.
Ricky, that doesn't frustrate me, the $2 or the other example, because those are isolated cases. What does frustrate me a bit is the fact that you have developers that go under the guise of good intentions in the beginning and get the USDA funds, and they build these low-income apartments, and then suddenly 20 years later it's for the economic gain.
Sure.
That's the frustrating point, because the intent was not a good purpose.
Sure.
They knew what they were doing.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's a bigger scale.
Right.
Much bigger than that.
Oh, it's huge. It's, you know, what was it, Ivor, about 3 years, 4 years ago, when the majority of those units came up nationwide, and in South Carolina alone, there were over 15,000 units that opted out.
And they tightened up those tax credits to keep that one.
Not from that. There's another tax credit program that we work with CDIC, but and that's what we did Bush and all of that with. But yes, ma'am, some of it, you know, has tightened up. But it's the large tax credits under the new program. It's the largest producer of housing, and believe it or not, and we'll share that, it's not even a HUD program. It's Section 42 of the Internal Revenue Code, and I'll explain it to you in a minute, believe it or not.
This is a photo of our Stony Homes development. As I mentioned earlier, this is our oldest public housing development. And we're currently rehabbing this development. It's 44 units. We will hope to, by June, have a dedication ceremony. And we're going to start moving families back in within the next month or so. This program was funded by a capital bond financing program where a group of housing authorities in the state of South Carolina all pooled their resources together to tap into some of the bond financing that was available to rehabilitate public housing developments.
How much money was that deal?
This development was $2 million, right at $2 million to redevelop Stony Homes.
So it's your gated community.
Gated?
That's the way.
I'm waiting on you to do the gated response.
Do my legs better. What were they going to put?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. They did say that. Yeah. Oh, and then I heard something the other day that I never heard this one, that we had moved everybody out of Stony because we were bringing people from New Orleans that were affected by Hurricane Katrina, and we were remodeling them for Hurricane Katrina victims. So I've heard all kinds of stories of why we remodeled it.
They're beautiful.
Thank you.
This is our Bradley Homes. This is our only public housing development that's specifically designated to house senior citizens and those who are 55 years or older. These are 18 units, and some of them are on Marlborough Street, and some are also on Florence Street, located on the north side of those streets.
Those one bedroom, single
bedrooms. These are one bedrooms. We, up until about 4 years ago, we had 399 public housing units in Aiken County, and we demolished units formerly known as Bush Homes, which is a scattered site in Aiken. And we've also demolished Valley Homes and Garvin Homes. Valley Homes and Garvin Homes were in Bloverville, and that was about 109 units. This is now what is resemblance of what used to be Bush Homes. We turned Bush Homes into a low-income housing tax credit development, and we have, as you see, they're no longer public housing units, but single-family homes. This is a second phase of Bush Crossing, which is on Charleston Street and East Boundary and Thorpe Lane.
Let me interject something, and we're going to move forward, too. But just so you know, these were conventional public housing units that were built in the 50s. 50s. When I came to Aiken, Ms. Clavin and Ms. Price knows this very well. At least I don't know if you were here in 90. Were you here in 94? 95. Bush were built, Mr. Buckley, they were built without a vapor barrier. So the mildew and condensation on the interior and exterior, with the walls inside and outside, were completely black. And the families had mildew and all of those problems. And so while some of our board members, Mr. Stack used to bring this up all the time, that he wanted us to deal with crawl space opposed to flat, during that period of time because of cost and the cost of construction, you know, the irony of it is it was either leave Bush with people living in mold, mildew, kids getting sick, and potentially lawsuits for everyone. The walls were completely black. This is how bad it was in the wintertime, that we would go in, paint the unit, have the painters go in and paint the unit, and the next morning you would come in and done the paint was on the, because the paint would not even, I mean, it was that bad. The paint, they put it on the next morning because of the condensation and the moisture. All the paint had rolled off the wall and was on the floor. And so, you know, that's how bad the conditions were. And they had been here. I mean, Bush had been here since the 50s. And we demolished it, and we built back single-family units in that place. We used tax credits, some of it on Sumter Street, right in front of Smith Hazel. Those ended up being home ownership units, so we sold those to those families after living in them under lease purchase program. And then Carter Terrace and Marlboro Street are still rental units.
And this is the former Valley Homes. We've also replaced that with low-income housing tax credits. We have 34 single-family homes there. And then we have also, this is a 36-unit senior development. And right in front of it, there's also a community facility that we recently built as well, which will be the place where Head Start will operate its Head Start program in that community.
Is that a school or a mill building?
Not that one.
Oh, okay.
This is another one that we did, and that one tax credit was done by another developer for the old Warrenville school. Yes, ma'am.
Where is this in Warrenville?
It's on Gloverville. It's in Gloverville off Myrtle Drive.
It's beautiful.
This is the Smith House. This was named after Roland Smith. And so, but it's a, what, 36?
36.
36 one-bedroom units.
And the rents here are $400 a month. And it also includes utilities too for our seniors. They also have an exercise room, a library, gazebos in the back. And we try to add in different social services for the seniors as well in the community.
There's no management in that.
Oh yeah, we have a, we do have a property manager there who is there 3 days a week in that development. And then we also have an assistant person who assists as well.
The before Ivor goes on, going back to what we were talking about with CDSE, but I think it's important to note, when you look at the funding sources, that's where CDSE as a partner with Aiken Housing comes in, and we're going to make that correlation in a few minutes. But you get an equity investor, State Housing Finance Agency, the Federal Home Loan Bank of Atlanta. So the development of this property brought in three national, regional, statewide funding sources to be able to facilitate that. And those funds are not available to Aiken Housing. They're only available to for-profit or non-profit development corporations, but they're not available directly to a governmental entity like Aiken Housing Authority. So in order to facilitate those kinds of things, that's what we're talking about, why we have to create that other arm.
And this is Han Village, which I mentioned earlier, our largest development with 100 units. Han Village is one of our units that we also have in our plans to start doing some serious rehabilitation within the next 5 to 7 years. This is provides you information from New Hope 1 and New Hope 2, which are the developments that in the county. There's 29 units in New Hope 1 and 40 units in New Hope 2. I wanted to provide everyone information on our public housing tenant statistics. A lot of times we hear throughout the community that public housing is a generational cycle of poverty. And so I pulled this information because I thought it would be very, very beneficial as we go out into the community and talk to people about our public housing families. As you see down to the very bottom, the average residency stay is 5.7 years for our public housing residences. And then if you take a look at the elderly versus non-elderly, you'll see that a majority of the individuals are elderly individuals, and that's based a lot of times on their income. The Housing Choice Voucher Program, I think we've touched on that a little bit earlier as it relates to the program. So I'm going to go through some of these slides. I want to retouch back on it. This is our funding that we received from our Housing Choice Voucher Program, which shows a yearly funding from 1999 to 2008. About 10, 11 years ago, the Housing Authority only had 128 housing choice vouchers, and now we have funding to provide over 815 families with housing choice vouchers in the community.
So I think that what's important to note is that if you take, we talk about loss of jobs and the economic impact, if you take $32 million in federal money out of this community's rental housing, that would be a major blow, because the majority of those units are where people, most of them are private owners, there's not a lot of large landlords, but where individuals have bought newer homes and keep those other homes as rental property. In some cases they bought it as investor property. But as you can see, in a roughly a 9-year, 10-year period of time, we've put $32 million, and that's federal money. So the tenant pays 30% of their gross adjusted income for their portion of the rent. So that's just the portion that we put in from the federal government standpoint. That's not counting the tenant's portion, which would be about 30% of that amount over the same period of time. So if you can probably tell, that's an economic impact to the community in the rental housing of all probably about $45 million worth of investment over a 10-year period of time.
I think we covered that. And as we touched earlier on the landlord's obligation and housing authority obligation, we've already covered that piece of it. This is Section 8 housing choice voucher statistics. And under the housing choice voucher program, the average residency is about 5.4 years. And as you'll see, individuals typically stay on the Section 8 program after around 6 years, they're off the program. So we also want to touch bases on, this is the last program that will be covered under the Aiken Housing Authority's direct administration. But this is a summer food service program. We were contacted by Aiken County Council in 2006. To begin operating the summer food service program. They had currently operated summer food service program, I would say probably about 10 years in Aiken County. And their Parks and Recreation Department had operated the program, and they had very limited staff, so they began working with us to operate the program and provide you some information on the program. From Aiken County's operation to Aiken Housing Authority's operation. Last year we served 63 sites in Aiken County. We provided over 2,700 breakfast and lunch meals during the summer months. We ran that program from June to August. And the summer food service program is typically designed to provide school-aged children with meals while school is out, and individuals who typically qualify are those who qualify during the school year for free or reduced lunch. Next we'll do CDIC's presentation.
Okay, and Ira and I are going to do this together again because the WIA program really is her bailiwick and her expertise, because she brings years of experience with that program. So I'm gonna defer to my esteemed colleagues for that part of it. Very quickly, we created CDSC, going back to what we were talking about. We saw a need in the community, and I had a a board that had the fortitude. The federal government was talking about welfare to work and all of those different programs. And the Housing Authority Board and I, we sat down and talked about the conditions, the living conditions. We talked about the dilapidated housing that was existing in the city. When we did our inspections and we saw the type of houses that was a choice for people to rent under Section 8 was extremely limited. And so there were no private developers doing any of that kind of work in the community. And so what I did is I asked the board, because I've been involved in community development type programs in my previous life before taking over the Housing Authority, I asked the board if we could create a nonprofit development arm. And so you may say, well, why create a nonprofit development arm? Very quickly, in the 1960s, when the Internal Revenue Service created 501c3s, housing authorities are state quasi-governmental nonprofits. They don't have a federal designation as a nonprofit. They're only state quasi-governmental nonprofits. So all of your funding sources, your federal funding sources, your equity funding sources, all of those funding sources does not allow a housing authority to be the applicant. The only applicant it can be is a 501c3 nonprofit development arm. So I want to kind of liken that to Aiken Corporation is to the city of Aiken. There are certain things that the city of Aiken cannot do. There are certain opportunities that you can avail yourselves to as a city by creating Aiken Corporation. So CDIC, in essence, is Aiken Housing Authority's arm, just like Aiken Corporation is for you all. And so we created CDIC. It was, the first name was New Labor Housing and Economic Development, and we changed that. And it was New Labor because our first initiative was when the government was going and working with welfare work programs. And we were the only housing authority in the country that was a direct recipient from the Federal Department of Labor to operate the welfare work program. Because my goal when I took over the housing authority, funny that Mr. Goldman was chairman when I came in, and he's chairman now. But when my goal when I took over the agency and they interviewed me, as I said, my goal was the first day we take applications for people to move in public housing is the first day that I wanted to be for people to move out of public housing. I spent 20 years of my career, and however those have heard me say this a lot, that I spent 20 years of my career managing and directing public housing, and I never liked public housing. And so I did that because I wanted to spend my career helping people get out of public housing, not necessarily to stay in public housing. We do a good job of putting people in public housing. We did a poor job nationally of getting people out of public housing. And I like to say that our board and this community as a whole, because you all are part of this, have done a wonderful job of us working together from a collaborative standpoint to get people off of government assistance and out of public housing. We do that through our workforce investment program that I've heard talk about, and we do that through our other housing components. And so the mission of Aiken Housing Authority is to facilitate the creation of affordable housing, homeownership, and economic development opportunities for low-income families in the low-income communities.
But to just add to that, we work with you with welfare to work programs at Riverside.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And that's where, and let me say this, that, you know, my wife laughs when friends call and say, when is Reggie going to leave Aiken? Yeah, it's a little small community. Why is he still at that small housing authority down in Aiken? You can be able to go a lot of other places. And I've said this many times, and I continue to say this today, that we have a wonderful community here in Aiken. And we got a spirit. And Ms. Price and Ms. Clavin know that, you know, and I'm not trying to say anything against Steve Thompson when he was city manager, but when I went to Steve, and I'll never forget, came to city council, Mr. Goldman came with me, and the housing authority had gone through dilapidation, and we wanted city help to trim some trees on the property. And Steve Thompson was city manager at the time, and Steve said to the council while I was here that, well, they get money from the federal government, and we don't have anything to do with them. We never had anything to do with them, you know, and we don't have any oversight, and they get money to do that kind of stuff. And I said to city council that day and say, now, He's absolutely correct. We do get money to do all that. But I got my job because somebody else lost their job and they didn't do what was supposed to be done to manage the property correctly, and we need your help. And Michael Anacleri was on city council, and I can remember like it was yesterday, Mike Anacleri said these words, and he said, who is also a man on CDLC board, Mike said, the people that live in Hunt Village are citizens of Aiken, just like the people that live in Woodside. And whatever we do for one, we should do for all. And so the city lended their help to trim the trees and to get a lot of that dead trees, because if you go through Hunt Village, there are a lot of trees over there. And that was the beginning. And Roger came outside when it was over, and he and I started talking about it. He said, give me a call tomorrow and we'll work on it. Shortly thereafter, Roger became city manager, and we've had a wonderful relationship of working with the city ever since. And so I say that to say that this has been a wonderful community to work in. I'm looking forward to continue to work in and to do some wonderful stuff. This is our board members of CDSC. We have some community people that serve on there. Connie Johnson, whose name is on there. Ms. Johnson lived in public housing for 18 years when I came to the Housing Authority. She worked with different people cleaning homes in the community. And I went to Ms. Johnson one day and I said, Ms. Johnson, you make $100 a week. I bet you can make $100 a day. You are a true Molly Mae. You don't have to, you can start your own business. And without telling Ms. Johnson's business, I will say that Ms. Johnson has made in some years over $50,000 a year operating her own business. And that's a true success story of somebody that lived in public housing. And when I resigned and we were talking, she said, Mr. Barnum made me believe in myself and believe in my family and what we could do. And that's what we've been able to do at Aiken Housing Authority for the last 13 years. So when you hear what we're talking about, it's not just about money, and it's not just about housing. It's about the relationships that we've developed with people one-on-one and changing their family and their lives around. And we've known them and we've worked with them closely. And that's why we do the Workforce Investment Program, because our goal is to help people get into home ownership and to get off of government assistance. Go ahead, Aaron. And we're going to move on. These are some of the funding sources. As you can see, these are a lot of the funding programs that we've gotten awards. As you can see, we've built and bought a lot of property in the community. And these are some of the financial awards that we've been able to receive in the community. One of the things that I do want to highlight is that as we've gotten these programs, we have worked with the South Carolina State Housing Finance Agency. I serve now on the Federal Home Loan Bank Board of Atlanta, the advisory board in Atlanta, and we get a lot of funding from them, Lower Savannah Council on Government, and stop right here. And so as you can see, just in operating CDFC and bringing funding to build better quality housing in the Aiken County community, in 9 years, through developing CDFC, we've been able to bring in $29 million worth of housing development in this community in 9 years. To bring affordable housing, as Ms. Price talked about, those other units that opted out, we brought $29 million worth of money into this community to bring back affordable housing units. The other thing that we focus on that is on workforce housing issues that we work on, and then go back one time, workforce investment, we're going to talk about, but I want to talk about micro lending and small business program, intermediary re-lending program as well. We receive money from the Federal Home Loan Bank Board of Atlanta. Part of our mission of CDFC is not only to build housing, but it's also to focus on economic development. And so one of the things that we're focused on as well, and these are some of the units that we've done, is we loan money for small businesses in the community from $3,000 up to $1.5 million. And the goal of it is they have to be located in a low-income census tract, have to create jobs in low-income communities, and bring development into blighted or low-income areas of the community as well. And so that is how we work with it. And the other thing that I want to talk about is tax credits. I'm going to get to new markets, but I want to share with you on housing tax credits. The South Carolina each state gets $1.85 per capita in tax credits from the U.S. Department of Treasury. And then we apply for those tax credits. And when we apply for those tax credits, we sell those credits to a syndicate. And so what we end up doing, and the Housing Authority can't do that, it has to be a part of the nonprofit development arm that can access those credits. We get the tax credits. We sell the credits to a syndicator, which is like Wall Street. We sell the credits. They pay us, last year they paid us 94 cents on the dollar. So as you can see, if we have a $3 million development that we want to do, and we get $3 million tax credits, the investor pays us 90 cents on the dollar. We get that cash, and then we get to build the units. So if it's $3 million in credits, we get about $2.6 million. And so then all we have remaining to be able to build that development is about $400,000 worth of funds that we have a gap to be able to build. And then we get grant funds and other funds to be able to bring that in. The other program that's available that we're beginning to work with, and you will hear, so that way I want to let you know this, because I'm getting in front of you on this one, because this is important. When you hear people in the community talk about Reggie is working with Aiken County to build a new county complex, when you hear people say CDSC is working with the county to build a new county complex, when you hear people say CDSC is helping to bring a new interchange in, that's not me. Oh, I thought it was me, sorry. If you hear people say that CDSC is working with the community to bring a new interchange in on I-20, all of those economic development activities, let me share with you why and how. All of those things are based on the fact that if the county would take the county building and build it on this side, I want to use Ruthven Avenue as an example. If we go down Ruthven Avenue, if the county was to build it on the side where the high school is, it gets no tax credits. If the county builds it in that cotton field, it gets tax credits. Not because it's a cotton field. Next to the credit, not because it's a cotton field, but because of the census tract that the Federal Department of Treasury designates national. So if you develop, you remember when we grew up and people say, you live on the other side of the track? Well, now, the other side of the track has major federal incentives to develop. If you develop on the north side of Aiken, it is a low-income census tract because it's never been developed. It's an underdeveloped census tract. If we develop on the south side, you can't get those federal credits. So why? And this is how much credits we're talking about. $3.9 billion in federal credits. Wachovia Bank, for the last 4 years, has gotten $150 million a year in credits. Carolina First Bank got their first allocation in new market tax credits in 2007 of $100 million. And the intent is that the banks get the credits, the corporations use the credits against their federal income taxes for 7 years, but they make an investment into blighted or low-income areas to bring economic development in that region. Because otherwise, no one without those credits, businesses won't locate in those areas. They locate in, because it's all driven based on supply, demand, and market. As a quick example, Bilo wanted to expand. And Bilo said, we're going to build another Bilo on the south side of Aiken down Whiskey Road. The developers went to Bilo and said, why not build on the north side? And they said, no. So why not? Well, we don't think that there's a market. Well, everybody in Aiken was driving to the south side to go to Bottle. So Bottle said, we'll come to the north side of Aiken, but we're only going to come and we'll pay where we're paying $12 a square foot on the south side. We're only willing to pay $8 a square foot on the north side. And we still want 50,000 square feet. We want it designed this way, and we want it to look a certain way. So if you're the developer, and you got $8 a square foot, and construction cost is not changing because it's on the north side of Aiken, the cost is still the cost. But when you get incentives and incentivized by the ability to access the tax credit, because what Wachovia Bank does, and Carolina First Bank, and those banks do, is they make a loan, and they make what is called an A-B loan. They make an A loan, and they make a B loan. And the B loan is a forgiven loan over a seven-year period of time because the bank takes the credits against their bank corporate income taxes for making investments in low-income communities or blighted areas to help spur economic development. And the only way that you can get it is by working with a nonprofit development arm that helps and is created and designed to help bring economic development to low-income areas. And what it does is it's intended to help create jobs.
Are you saying that the CDIC is already committed to supporting this choice of location for the county office?
No, I use that as an example.
All right.
No. Please. All I was doing was using it. Please, Ms. Barber. That is not what I was saying.
Good. No, that's what it, I'm sorry, but okay. You know, the irony to me here, and I'll just be real quick, is that I think this was started to help blighted downtown areas where nobody would locate anymore.
No.
And what I don't want to see happen is for this kind of a grant to be one of the reasons that we don't have the variety of business that we need to keep this downtown viable, because we didn't make the mistake everybody else did 30 years ago of moving everything fun after the bypass. You know what I mean?
No, but it wasn't intended for downtown.
It wasn't?
No, ma'am. Not the federal New Markets Tax Credit Program. The number one criteria right now, if you go on the Federal Department of Treasury's website, you can't even get funding for it now unless it's focused in rural areas of your community. If you don't focus in rural areas of your community to help bring economic development, you can't even get a priority in your application. So all of the banks make it clear that we're going after $150 million. It's $3.9 billion that was awarded back in December for New Markets Credits nationally. And you can only get it if you focus in rural or blighted areas.
So you aren't involved with this now, this county office company?
Yes, we are, but it's not in that location. I was only using it to show an example of what's an eligible area and what's not an eligible area. So please, in no way am I saying it's on brother. And I was just using that for example purposes only, okay?
But it is fair to say, is it not, that if you participate in the program with the county or with any other public agency, you have the advantage of being able to use this grant money.
It's not a grant.
Well, New market tax credits.
Right. The corporation gets the credits.
Yes.
And we get the benefit of the investment into the community.
But the net result would be, just to take the county with an example, and I won't pin you down, it's better to build on one side of the bypass than the other, defining the bypass as where Aiken Valley and the standard, Aiken standards.
And give you another example. We were meeting with a group Friday, so let's take the county out of it. Right. I was using it then. I was meeting with a company that came in that Robert Long and works with Fred Hughes' group. We were referred to give us a call. They want to bring in a call center to Aiken. I won't divulge. They want to bring a call center into Aiken. Well, where they want to locate is in a census tract that would be eligible. And it could potentially bring in 120,000 square feet of jobs and property to be developed in a blighted low-income area. And so the company wants to locate in a census tract where they can get the incentives of these federal credits that the banks get to utilize. Mm-hmm. And so it brings jobs into the area, and we're focused on Grand Deal. You know, same thing. It helps to, if we can help re-spur and redevelop Grand Deal, all of Grand Deal got the benefits of a lot of things. It gets historic tax credits. It gets textile credits. It gets new markets credits. Do y'all realize that, I'm going to give you an example. With all of the credits that were available, if we could recruit industry back in Grand Deal, do you recognize that with our help and the access capital that we can have bringing, that whoever, if they spent $100 million in redevelopment, they would only have to end up spending $50 million of loaned money, because the credits that can be received in all of the different programs would be available because of what's already available because of when those properties were.
Reggie, let me just say to you that say that this is just not available just to Aiken. What's happening right now is happening around the country.
Yeah.
Aiken,
so, go ahead, please.
Until you came on the scene, Aiken is just really getting into fully utilizing what's available around the country that other folks have managed to. Atlanta, for example, some of those areas
are. And South Carolina as a whole.
Right.
Carolina First Bank got credits last year. The program has been around since 2000. And do you realize that that's the first time any bank in South Carolina, or anybody, because we've applied but we've not gotten it, anybody has gotten new markets tax credits in South Carolina? Greenville, let me retract. Greenville, City of Greenville created Aiken Corporation, their subsidiary, and in 2006, the City of Greenville got $90 million in new markets tax credits.
The calls I get are about, does Grandville need to incorporate to get these things? That does not matter, does it?
It has nothing to
People
do.
People call me and they say, what is this? Can they get money if they do that?
It has nothing.
I don't know.
Ms. Barber, it has nothing to do with it. Uh-huh. This is Beach Alley, Wagner. We're talking Aiken.
It doesn't
matter. As long as it's outside the city limits of Aiken, and even if it's in the city limits of Aiken, it doesn't matter. As long as it's in a blighted area, census tract, it's all driven by the Federal Department of Treasury. And what we do is it's geocoded. We go in, we put in a street address, and it tells us if it's a high poverty census tract, and if it's a high poverty census tract, it's an eligible area. And that's when that's the first thing we do with business people is to say, this is where you can build it. And so they'll come to us and say, Reg, I got three sites I'm looking at. And we plug in those addresses and we say, two of them work, one doesn't. So they can build it where they want to, but if they want the incentives, there was only one site of the three that they're looking at that they can get that financial benefit. And if you're looking at $10 million, and you can get the benefit of 25% of that, so if you don't have to pay back $2.5 million of $10 million, there are a lot of businesses that can be able to pass that on and create jobs and bring jobs into the community. They want those tax credits, and that's where we can help facilitate.
Jane, the benefit of incorporation, I think, the gratitude would be if receiving all these funds, the planning of all this, where things are going to go. Otherwise, you just don't have a plan in terms of how the design is going to work.
But our role, going back with that, is twofold. Our goal is to help facilitate and serve from a stimulus capital standpoint. And so that's kind of where we are.
Do you have a map, or is there a map available that shows which of the sites in and around, I'm just focusing now on the city of Aiken, not in Gloverville, where these blighted areas are that are going to be more likely to be developed?
Yes or no?
Yeah. there's no map that we have.
But you can create one from going on the site.
Yeah, you just put in an address, and it tells you, is it high poverty or just poverty? Is 50% of the people that live in this area at poverty level, or is it 40%? So, and then based on the poverty level, the higher the poverty level, the better the benefit of moving a business into that area.
And so you work directly with the companies that want to come here. And if you and the companies agree on a given site and it qualifies and so forth, then they will work through you and build the project.
Right. We help them facilitate the financing of getting their finances together to do those kind of projects.
And depending on where it is, then it would enter the city or the county planning process. If
it's just a regular business, all we're working on is the financing of it. So, I mean, nothing changes, you know, no matter what the business is. Everything, it's just like if you came and said, Reggie, I want to open, you know, a Bojangles. Well, are you going to open the Bojangles on Richland, or are you going to open the Bojangles on your path by? And then I can tell you, I'll plug the address in and say, Dickie, it won't work on Richland Avenue,
okay. But
it looks good on York.
It seems that a map showing generally where these areas are would be a very handy planning tool and probably would be a valuable thing for the council members to have.
Well, and Mr. Buckley, let me say this as a potential or incoming board member. What we try not to do is that is a business
opportunity
right. For us, because there are a lot of other for-profit entities that facilitate and do this. We do earn a financial benefit for helping to facilitate this process. So any for-profit company, you know, as Ms. Price said, you know, nobody was pushing New Market tax credits until I started going to meetings and talking about how beneficial New Market tax credits can be. Well, we want that to be beneficial to CDSC, but then we can earn that fee and then build more affordable housing in the community off of what we earn. If other private entities get a whiff, if you will, of Aiken is really gung-ho on putting New Market tax credits together, then they come in with all their sophistication and big lawyers and teams, and they earn the fee and take that money back out of the community. Where with us, we earn those fees and recycle it back into community by building affordable housing or helping to create jobs and those kinds of things. So, you know, while we're mindful of that, we still try to, a not-for-profit organization still earns a profit. The difference is what we do with it. In our case, we put that money back into creating more housing opportunities and job opportunities for low to moderate income families. And so we put it back into the community opposed to somebody taking it out of this neighborhood.
Well, now how is the county going to lose that advantage? They're just not going to have to pay back as much money if they use something like this.
Right, whether it's the county, the city, I mean, you all got the same, you know, anybody has the same benefit to use these programs. The difficulty is it looks at how many jobs are you retaining, how many jobs are, you know, like if a plant was proposing to leave, or, you know, what it does for the county, it allows you to bring 900 employees potentially into one location, which then creates food, restaurants, gas stations, all of those things, and depending upon where you put it, it could help facilitate those kind of projects.
Yeah, USDA does pretty much the same thing.
Right, and we are a lender. We just got approved as a CDIC is a IRP lender. We get $750,000 per increment from USDA at 1% interest rate for 30 years. We get to set an interest rate, and the spread we get to earn. And so if we set an interest rate for a small business at 5% when the bank is offering 7%, we can give them a small business loan up to $150,000. They get the difference from the bank. And so what we've been able to do is help them get lower cost of capital to be able to facilitate their senior piece.
But you just started that.
Yeah, we just got that award. And matter of fact, we're in the process of closing that loan. So as you can see, and once we use that $750, it's at 1% to us. So if we set it at 5%, we earn a 4% spread. And again, those investments and that money go back into CDIC, which then goes back into the community again. And we're helping small businesses get started and get loans. So we can loan up. And so we even got another pool from the Federal Home Loan Bank of Atlanta for $35,000. And then Wachovia Bank chose us out of 13 nonprofits from D.C. all the way to Florida for what is called a PR program. And we were selected. One was in the metro Atlanta area, and they chose one other nonprofit out of 13 nonprofits from D.C. to Florida. They chose CDSC. We got $1 million approved in $500,000 increments where we can loan money to small businesses, again, up to $75,000. And we got the money from Wachovia. They loaned it to us at 2%. We get to set our own rates back in the community below market for up to a 20-year period of time that we get to do those loans. So as you can see, CDIC's role is to serve as a housing and economic development arm of the authority to access this capital that we can put it back and make investments to help businesses, help create jobs and those kinds of things in the community.
Do you make an annual report to the city council?
We haven't in the past. Now you all get a copy of our, you know, the city gets a copy of the audits and all of those kinds of things, but we've not done a formal report.
Well, technically you have a board that you report to that we have no hands on with you in terms of how the board governs the housing authority. But let me just say that with the leadership of your board and passing on a serious term of president, I believe, James is serving as president. I've just been amazed over the years at the ability that they've given you to be creative in so many things. This is not the same times it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when you started, things moved 10 years ago, as a matter of fact, with the housing, and it's just been unbelievable changes with your leadership. And the fact that your board has allowed you to be creative in so many different things has really enhanced this town greatly to eradicate the black areas in this town.
Let me just say that, you know, as I sit in the board meetings a lot of times, and when Reggie came on board and started some of that talk of stuff that we had no idea what in the heck he was talking about. And then still sometimes, now we don't even know what he's talking about sometimes, but one of the key things that you all may be missing is what Reggie keeps going back to. All of this has one major goal, and that's to generate income to provide affordable housing for our people. So we may be in the process of doing some things that are out of the box, but my only concern, and I know that Sarah and I have talked a lot, and we look at what are we going to do, as how in the world are we going to help people be able to have some affordable housing. It's no secret, as we look around Aiken and some of the streets that used to be a moderate income type, now all of a sudden there are houses that we can't afford and all. So somebody has got to worry and concern themselves with how are we going to really help people with affordable housing. And so while a lot of this stuff is going on, in the background, I'm keep saying to myself and keep asking the question, are we doing what we're supposed to be doing as a housing authority board, generating the income to be able to provide affordable housing to people? Because if we don't watch it, we're going to find that some poor people aren't going to have a house or be able to ever own a home or have a decent place to live, because the decent places, it's just going to be too far out there. So I look at the CDIC part in terms of what it brings in and generates and allows us to get that affordable housing to low-income people.
And in a segue to kind of bring closure, with what Mr. Garland said, I was going to talk very quickly because we wanted to just keep it to 2 hours, is to talk about WIA, because not only do we look at the housing component and the economic development component, we received a grant from North Savannah Council of Government and the Department of Labor to operate the Workforce Investment Act program, and that is to help individuals get the skills and the training necessary to get a better paying job.
Let me ask you one quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
Who's a member of the board? I thought all the members of the Housing Authority were on the CDIC board.
They are.
Oh, okay.
So all of the Housing Authority board members are on, and they only represent 49%, because what happens is, from a funding standpoint, what the funders look at is it cannot be controlled by appointed or elected officials to get those funds. So the Housing Authority board members, we created it, Ms. Walters, to make sure that the oversight was there, where it just didn't get loosey-goosey out there. So that's why the Housing Authority board members serve on CDIC's board, but they cannot be no more than 49%, because all of these funding sources that we go after says you can't have a majority of people that are appointed or elected officials to serve on those boards. So that's why it's a 49% makeup. Now, they can increase that board, but it cannot be any more than, or any less, any more than 49% of Housing Authority board members.
So there are 11 members?
There are 11. We got some vacancies on there.
And then you choose to replace?
Right. Because we try, our bylaws say we choose people that are elected by neighborhoods or elected by the communities that we work in to serve on that board. So that's how they get on CDIC board.
Last program before we go into our summary section and highlights is the Workforce Investment Act program. We've been operating the Workforce Investment Act program and Welfare to Work program, which is our very first program that we were funded from the Lower Savannah Council of Governments office since 1998 to presently. Anytime we have a dislocation of employees in our community, whether it be a plant closure or downsizing, in Aiken County, we are the individuals who receive those grant fundings to help individuals be retrained so that they can get back into the workforce. For example, we have a little over 500 individuals in our program now who are all a part of the Avondale Mills dislocation. Plant closure. And those individuals, we've helped them to, from a variety of different ways. We've helped some of them even go back to school and get their GEDs. We've helped individuals get two-year degrees. And when I say help, we pay for their two-year degrees. We've also paid for any supportive services, like, for instance, if a family is having difficulty paying their mortgage for the month, we have funds to pay for their mortgage. We pay child care to help address the barriers for the family being reemployed. We also pay under the Avondale Mills dislocation, because it was related to the North American Free Trade Act, which means that anytime a company downsizes due to moving their company overseas, the individuals who are employed at one of those companies are eligible for additional weeks of unemployment insurance. Well, we pay those individuals monies every week in the form of a trade payment or trade stipend to help them as they go through the process of being retrained and re-entering the workforce. We have about 12 individuals in our agency who are employed up under this particular program, and these individuals are housed at various locations throughout our community. They're housed at Aiken Employment Security Commission office, Aiken Technical College, and the Avondale Transition Center on York Street. And I'm going to go to the highlights and summary. section. As we went over earlier, I just want to sum up everything by giving some highlights of what our organization has done over its history. When Mr. Barnett took over 13, 12 years ago, the Housing Authority had 390 public housing units and 126 Section 8 vouchers. And now we have over 855 Section 8 vouchers, and we've developed or managed over 640 units. And those units consist of low-income housing tax credit units, units for homeownership, and in our rental portfolio. We've also, Aiken Housing Authority and CDIC Collaborative have garnered over $71 million, and there's the breakout between the two entities to stimulate housing, workforce, and economic development initiatives. We've also, there's a multifamily construction developments that we've done that are outside. Some are in Aiken and some are outside of Aiken. Villages at Beaver Dam Creek is our development that we have in Edgefield, South Carolina. The Smith House is in Gloverville. And Cedar Springs is one that we currently have that we're working on receiving funding.
Let me interject something on that one. And we have one more, Deerfield Village. Hopefully you got that down in a second. The Cedar Springs development, we were contacted, and just to share with you all, where you, when you say we're working outside of the city of Aiken, Aiken Housing Authority only works in Aiken County. CDIC is a nonprofit. We were asked by state housing and other entities to help facilitate housing because of our expertise in other parts of South Carolina. So Cedar Springs development under CDSC, we're developing in Spartanburg. It's a 48-unit senior housing development for deaf and blind seniors. The South Carolina School for the Deaf and Blind asked the state to develop housing for deaf and blind seniors, and they recommended CDSC because of our expertise. And so we're developing now a tax credit development in Spartanburg, 48-unit senior development for deaf and blind seniors that will go into occupancy within the next 2 months. We work with the Catholic Church and the Diocese out of Savannah to in a single-family tax credit in Deerfield Village. That's on 321 in Hardyville, South Carolina. So if you're ever going down that way, we just built on Hardyville on 321 a beautiful 26-unit single-family tax credit development down in Hardyville. Again, there are a lot of people that work on Hilton Head Island, can't afford to live on Hilton Head, but live in Jasper County, which is the adjacent county. And so we work with the Catholic Church. Again, we were asked because of our expertise to help facilitate that. So we did that as well. So we are, and then Saluda Crossing, we work with the town of Saluda, and we develop housing in Saluda for them. And then Beaver Dam, as Ivory said, that's a senior development in Edgefield, adjacent to DSS and right behind the hospital in Edgefield. So we've been sought after to help facilitate affordable housing development, and I chair the Lieutenant Governor's Task Force on Workforce and Rural Housing right now to address these kind of issues.
What? Let me just ask you,
yes,
ma'am. People coming, why are you involved in that interchange on I-20?
Because we're involved in the interchange going back to the New Markets Tax Credits, and also look at the state of South Carolina. Governor Sanford put $1 million last year into the CDC tax credit legislation. This program was created by Governor Hodges, but Governor Sanford likes the program. Matter of fact, he's the only governor that has put $1 million in his budget line item into this program. And what it does, Ms. Barbers, is you have to be an approved nonprofit CDE, community development entity. And the intent was that you donate money to a approved nonprofit like CDIC. We help push this legislation. And then CDIC takes that money from corporate donors, individuals or companies, You donate money to us, and the state of South Carolina gives you a 33% tax credit against your state income taxes. And then we make an investment back into the community to help stimulate economic development in blighted, low-income areas. So when we're trying to help Warrenville, Graniteville, Vaucluse, it helps to bring potential jobs in that area. There was a study that was done that said if there was an interchange there, then you could help bring jobs into that community. So we have corporations, AT&T, Scanner, some of those corporations as well as individuals are donating the $5 million to get the tax credits to help bring in an interchange to be able to facilitate that where we can help bring in jobs to this region.
Does it have to come to fruition for the tax credits to be good?
Yes. Once they make the investment to us, we will hold those funds until we have enough money to make the investment to help build that interchange.
So it might be in that, it might be, the donation might be for that purpose, it might be for another purpose?
Give you another example.
But I mean, do they donate to a particular project, or does your board decide what?
Right, our board votes and decides. We get projects that I bring to the board to say, here's some projects that we can take a look at. They vote to decide whether or not we're going to enter into those projects to help make those donations. So whether we take money for housing development, whether we work with United Way Potential on the project, that people can donate money to us, and then we donate it back to United Way to help facilitate it, we're able to do those kinds of things. Right now, we're helping to, the Y is one of the things that we're working with. People donate money to us. We're donating that money to the Y. What it ended up being able to do is people increase their donations because they were donating money anyway. But then when they can get a 33% tax credit, then they donate the money to us. We donate it to the Y opposed to them just giving it to the Y directly by giving it to us, and we make an investment. And it's all intended to help the community grow, but people get a tax credit. And
but when the Y advertises, they don't say to donate to CDIC, do they?
Well, they do now. All of their written materials now, since we worked together to adopt this, now they have on all of their literature that to donate to CDIC. And then we give you an example. This year alone, for 2007, over $28,000 was donated to CDIC to go towards the Y.
How do you make sure somebody doesn't have a conflict of interest in the school?
When you say conflict of interest, what do you mean? Like a vested interest?
You're donating money to get the CDIC to do a project that's going to ultimately make you money. So you're getting a 33% tax credit to start out with.
Well, I think that we have to look at the bigger picture. Is I think that we, a lot of times that what we do is say somebody's going to get a benefit. Well, the reality of it is, all of us are going to get that benefit. I mean, and I'm not trying to be funny, we live in a capitalistic society, and so, the government created an opportunity for 1 in 10 and 1 in 10 only, and that is to help stimulate capital without going up on taxes for taxpayers. And so if they can give an incentive, if you will, for a company or an individual to donate without us having to help, this is a private interchange.
I just worry, though, when wealthy individuals get tax credits, that's going to affect our state tax rate. I mean, if they don't pay 33% of their tax that they would normally pay, that's huge.
But I guess we have to look at the catalytic effect. Uh-huh. And what I would say is if we take a $5 million donation in credits, and let me give you a quick example. The property that's adjacent to the interchange is 1,000 acres of only 2 mega sites in South Carolina that could potentially bring an automotive plant. If we could recruit, Kia had chosen that plant before they went to Georgia. If you look in Greenville at the same thing, when BMW came, While BMW may only create 4,000 jobs, the supplier network is typically 8 to 10 times that of what one employer brings. So when we look at that tax credit benefit that we're talking about of $5 million, then when we look at being able, because what the automotive industry says is, we don't want you to promise us an interchange. We want a site where there's already an interchange. So we, when we're deciding on whether we're going to go to North Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, we want a ready site. And you can't get an interchange in 90 days. And so when we look at the 4,000 jobs times 8 or 10, potentially 20 to 30,000 jobs potentially in this region because of the supplier network for automotive plant, then my question would be back to us as a community. Was it better utilized to not use state funds, or, as we know right now, the Infrastructure Bank of South Carolina is broke? So if we don't use infrastructure funds, which are not available, we don't use state legislature funds, and it's donated by corporations and individuals that have a tax credit benefit, AT&T is given $500,000. Scanner is given $1 million for this interchange. So they're getting a benefit because whoever these companies that come in, they're going to use SCNG as their in AT&T. So I understand, don't get me wrong, I understand fully what you're saying, but the catalytic effect of the benefit, and believe it or not, the Federal Department of Highways and the state, Ms. Clyburn sits on that Arts Commission, the state Department of Transportation is supportive in that way. And it really has said, this is the first time in South Carolina, which excites people, that it's the first time in South Carolina that there's a potential that an interchange is not costing the taxpayers directly.
Yeah, but you know, what's disturbing, I guess, and I, if I think through it more, and I will work hard to do that, I might understand it, but it seems as though we have two civic administrations. We have the city of Aiken with elected officials and boards and commissions, and we have the county of Aiken with boards and commissions, and you're going off and doing your thing, and these folks are, victims, not the right word, but recipients of whatever you do, whether they have a role in it or not. So there might be some things that, I mean, not everybody in the community, for example, would might want some of the projects that you would support. I mean, an automobile plant, it would be wonderful. I've yet to see anything that says we've got the education support to be able to staff a high-tech facility like that. I mean, we're doing wonderful things with Aiken Tech and the work with the education we're doing, but we still have a 50% graduation rate.
But the
idea that an auto plant would
I think you can do a little bit more research and find that in Mississippi and Alabama, what they found was the complete opposite of what you just said. And they found that with the textile employees that were dislocated and lost their jobs because of their work ethic and their commitment and their ability, that they ended up in Mississippi, in the Delta of Mississippi and Alabama, where Mercedes-Benz and Kia and Toyota and all of them are going. They found in those most rural areas of our country with the less education of any state, that they found that they ended up being the best workforce. And what they said to us regionally in this area is two things. The intellectual knowledge base that we got from SRS and the textile base that had a long history in this community with those individuals and their work ethic makes Aiken and the Granville area prime for an automotive plant.
We did not have the education base when they put Savannah Riverside out there either.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
you're right. You're so correct, Barry.
But it didn't kill
them. What percentage of that workforce moved into Aiken?
Well, I'm sure you moved people in, but they're here now, and that's how the city was able to grow. And I'm my thinking is that first thing you said indicates to me before Reggie said it is that. Look at Mississippi. Look at where these plants are going. They're going where There is not so much the educational level of the people, but the work ethics of the people is there. And if you've got good work ethics, you can train them. And I think that's what they're looking at.
I thought I recall reading in that one of the reasons that Kia didn't come here was education.
Kia didn't come because of the proximity to the Hyundai plant, which was in Alabama, and access, two factors. Position to the Hyundai plant and interstate access were the main two.
Well, my comment still stands, and I still need to sort all through
sure,
this.
Sure, I can appreciate it.
It's almost like you're hitting planning commission. I applaud what you're doing, and I agree that profit by CDIC to help housing in Aiken is absolutely wonderful. But it seems like almost a kind of like a shadow government, if you would, where you're doing things absolutely legally and absolutely per your mandate, but it just seems as though we're going to find out, I guess, what happens when it happens.
Any project to the city that's going to come before the city planning commission, it's in the county, and it has to go before the county planning commission. They have to seek approval from both of those boards. Those boards are appointed by us.
That's a good point. You're right.
The only thing I'm working on is the financing and helping to work through the maze of the financial piece to help bring the project to fruition. All of the requirements it still has to pass, whether Sam's go here or there.
Whether the county building goes here or where?
It doesn't matter to me, and I don't go through those approvals. All I'm just trying to offer people is it creates jobs, it retains jobs, and it helps to facilitate growth of the community. And here's some resources that are being used by everybody else in America,
right,
but Aiken.
Plus, the profit of that comes back into the community to develop additional low-income housing.
That's correct.
When you do the housing thing, just remember, everybody can't get a big tax credit. There are a lot of small businesses that we want in our town.
Right.
We don't want it to be like Greenville,
sure,
where it's a Potemkin downtown, where the only things that are going are on the main street. You go one business off Main Street on most of those blocks, and there's nothing.
Sure.
And we don't want that. So I just, just remember, I feel, as a small business owner, I feel like small business is getting hammered in every direction and doesn't have the ability to donate for a big tax credit.
Sure.
They're trying to keep their employees. They're trying to make our town what we want it to be.
And what we do, Ms. Vargas, is just what you're saying. And I do this. When I served on the hospital board for 6 years, I said to Katie and I said to others, as we develop this community and we develop Aiken, if a doctor's office wants to build on the south side of Aiken, then I want to work with that doctor's office before they make a decision to build on the north side of Aiken, because the same incentives that we're talking about, because of Medicare, because of all those things that affect the doctor, if they would be willing to build their office on Hampton Avenue, then I can help that doctor's office get the same credits that we're talking about for anybody else. Now, that helps that doctor be more profitable when the insurance agencies and other people are not paying it. But the incentive is you put it on this side of town opposed to that side of town. And that's where we got to bring the resources. And that's all I'm trying to do.
Just don't forget downtown.
Yes,
that's
ma'am.
What I want to say. I'm not worried about the doctor's office.
Sure.
People are going to travel. They are.
Right.
And that's good. But I'm worried about other small businesses where location is huge.
And that's why we also do.
Our mission is to,
yeah,
to work
and
in
I
areas
like that.
That need the.
Right. But I just want.
Let me say to Dick in particular, we have sat with Reggie as a board, and we have gone over money and most of this stuff just to be sure, because we have a lot of the same concerns that you have, and we don't go in on blind faith on what Reggie says or anybody else. It's something that we as a board sit down and think about as well and try to be sure that we believe that we are doing what is in the best interest of this city of Aiken.
I think the bottom line is this, and that is that these funds are out there. somebody's going to get them. And I just as soon see them in Aiken as to see them in Greenville. And if you have any left over, you can take them down to Georgetown or Weaver. I just would rather see it come to South Carolina than all go somewhere else, or that most of it go somewhere else. And so it doesn't offend me that you develop in places where others have not thought to develop, because I think that helps those people in those areas to have a better life and less dependent on affordable housing. And I think it has its place in our society. It doesn't matter to me whether you work with somebody rich or poor. I think if you're going to get a good job done, it ought to get done if it's going to benefit people. And I don't think that bringing anything in is going to hurt downtown at all, because I think downtown is so viable here that I can't imagine that I would be hurting it if I supported something a little further out. I think we're going to be okay downtown.
And even on York Street or Highway 19, it's in the city. You know, those are low-income census tract areas. I mean, York Street beyond Richland Avenue, you know, for right now, is if you split Richland Avenue down, what's on that side of Richland right now is a low-income census tract. So if a business were to be built near and around First Baptist Church or anything like that, and still in the central business area of downtown, we would still be able to get Park Avenue. You know, those areas right now, Mr. Garman alluded to. The reality of it is now when a shotgun house that used to be $50,000 is now selling for $299, what's going to happen, though, is over a period of the next 3 to 4 or 5 years in the city, is those areas where we could take advantage of this, and that's why we're trying to seize the opportunity, they're going to be gone because the values of those houses go up. Because remember, the federal government looks at it as a census tract, and if it's a high-income census tract area, then we can't bring in those resources to that community.
President, let me just say to you that what you all have done in partnership with the city has made my life personally a lot easier based on phone calls. When we had the Black areas and the Tool Hill, the phone calls that we got in terms of public safety, the phone calls that I got, the seniors feeling unsafe, you've just changed that area 200-300%, where the calls have been reduced considerably throughout our city. And if what you're doing and your board is doing has done anything else, it has increased the safety in those areas for our community. Unbelievable, but people feel safe in their homes. They can walk out their door without feeling somebody's going to grab or attack them or break into their homes.
And I appreciate that. And the other thing that I want to say very quickly is that, and I would be remiss if I didn't say this, and that is City Council, you all took a bold step some years back in believing in Roger and believing in the vision and the direction of Roger. And I think the Sin Lapper magazine did a little article, Reggie and Roger, once. And, you know, but again, we've worked well together. And this is a wonderful community. I respect you all. I respect our differences, and I respect that we're not going to always agree and see eye to eye. I do appreciate the opportunity to talk about it, share, and we still may walk away without saying that we totally agree with each other, but what I do respect with you all, and I do appreciate it, has always been for the years I've been here, and that's why I like this community, is that we can sit down and talk about our differences, our difference of opinions, and come to a solution, and still, even when we agree to disagree, we do it in this community in a fashion that I don't see in other communities, even across the river. And that's why I enjoy working here. And I'm not saying that we still are going to agree, but I do appreciate the opportunity to work with you.
I didn't intend to convey any disagreement. We asked for this briefing primarily because there's so little that I knew less than I would like to have. You did an absolutely superb job in educating, I can speak for myself, me about Aiken Housing Authority and CDIC.
Well, I put all of this together.
Little idea of what you folks get, and I certainly appreciate it.
I didn't put the book together. I didn't touch it. She called me and said, meet her at the Housing Authority yesterday at 11 o'clock, and she put all
you
this
need
together.
To follow her more then.
Well, I did.
Great job.
She did a great job.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Pretty much, that's it. We do pay. The one thing that we wanted to highlight, Ivor and I talked about it, is we have a cooperation agreement with the city. We don't pay taxes for public housing. We pay a payment in lieu of taxes, but all of the new houses that we built, those are tax-paying facilities. So where we took units that were not taxable units off the road, we built back houses that do pay taxes. So as you can see, we're adding to the tax base, not taking away from
it. Are those the ones that you sell? Or
no, those are the ones that you just tax credit. All tax credit properties are taxable units. Yeah, the only units that are not taxable is public housing. But any tax credit units that we build, they're taxable units. And it's taxed based on the income valuation, not the value of the building. So that lets you see, we don't take away from it. We bring back to it.
Thank you.
Thank you.